Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, wherever you are in this great land, on this great planet. This is Ron, the webmaster of freeworldfilmworks.com. And tonight I'm being joined by Zizi from Afghanistan, who's going to tell you a story of what it was like to live in Afghanistan under Taliban rule. Go ahead, Zizi, and tell us your story.
Thank you so much for inviting me for tonight's show, and I would I feel honored to share my story and inspire some people here. So I always, since I came to the United States, I do motivational speeches for the young generation of this country to be educated and how people struggle for education in other countries. And we don't have these, we didn't have these great opportunities back in Afghanistan. I'm going to tell you my story, that how I struggle for getting education and came to the United States. I was born in 1997 during the first rule of the Taliban. I don't remember that first regime though, but my earliest memories are from the US occupation in Afghanistan. My father was very Western in his thinking and very opposed to the Taliban regime. We lived in Nangarhar province in the east, a very conservative and sometimes lawless part of the country. My father's attitude made him unpopular in our community, even within some people in our extended family. I remember my father taking us out on the roof of our house when I was just 4 years old. And he pointed at the dark mountains on the horizon, what looked like firecrackers were going off all around them. He told me there were people fighting up so that I could go to school. What I was seeing was the Battle of Tora Bora. I went to school and I loved to learn. I remember sitting in school, looking out on the window at a column of US military Humvees in a caravan going up the side of the mountains. I remember many of my classmates being scared or upset, but all I could think was, I wonder what it's looked like to be inside one of those Humvees. Life before the US occupation was very bad for women. They had no rights and were prevented from being educated. Even during the U.S. occupation, most of the society was strongly against Western culture, Western education, and about democratic government in Afghanistan. But my father had worked with the Russians during the Soviet-Afghan war, and so he had a very progressive view of women's rights. My sister were all educated as nurses and as doctors, and he encouraged me from my earliest age to learn as much as I could. In school, I was very good with languages. I learned Dari in Farsi and Urdu. As soon as I could, I started learning English language. This would have been impossible before the US occupation, and it was still very controversial when I did it. My community and my members of my family in Nangarhar discouraged me from being from learning the language of infidels. And I knew many locals were loyal to the Taliban, even some in my extended family. But my father encouraged me, and I loved it. There was always the threat of the Taliban, however, who opposed women's education, particularly English language, the language of infidels. During the U.S. invasion, the Taliban had been rooted into the mountains, in more remote parts of the country like Nangarhar. They were officially outlawed and their national power was depleted. But where I live, there were constant threats. Their message was clear. Anyone who helped U.S. forces or participant in Western reforms was fair game for murder or was worse than that. So even going to school meant taking my life into my hands. But I was determined. I went to school all day, so I had to walk home in the evening. It was very dangerous. My brother took classes with me, so I felt safer walking home. And my father bought a cell phone so we could call and let him know we were okay. So I always dream of being highly educated and independent woman, which was very challenging where women were not even allowed to speak up for themselves or walk outside of their houses without a male escort. But I was very lucky to grow up in an educated family and have a superhero father who supported me in achieving my dreams. Without him, I wouldn't be the strong, educated woman that I am today. But our lives were about to change. My life, my future, and the lives of my family members were about to be put to the greatest challenge possible. On a cold evening, March 2009, my brother and I were walking home. We had been in school all day, and we were practicing our English language on the way back to home. And all of a sudden, a silver car pulled alongside us. Two men with rifles jumped out. They screamed at us and stuck the guns in our faces. One of the men ripped my books away from me, including my thick English textbook. He taunted me and asked me why I was learning English language. He stuffed my brother and me into the back of the car. Then he picked up all my books and my backpack and threw them into the river. I watched my books flood down the river while the men laughed at me. I was so angry. I told them, "You can throw my books away, but you cannot pick the knowledge in my mind." They just laughed at me and they threw me into the car. At first, I thought they were just a couple of thugs kidnapping us for ransom. We were obviously school kids, so we were probably had some money. But then they kept asking me why I was learning English language. They were waved through the police checkpoints as we drove across the city. And those police checkpoints supposed to stop the car and search the car with a terrified girl and a boy in the backseat. That's when I knew we were in a real trouble. My phone was ringing. It was my father calling to check up on us. My kidnappers just left and turned the phone off. They drove us far into the mountains for hours and hours. Then the car stopped and we got out into the cold night and they made us walk. We walked until our shoes tore and then we walked barefoot. One of the men in the car was named Taj, and it became clear to me that he was the leader of the Taliban. It wasn't clear what exactly he wanted with us. There was an argument and conversations with the different people on their phone, mostly in Pashtun language that we didn't speak. The leader of the Taliban called my father and told him that he had taken us. He kidnapped us. He didn't make any demands. Then I didn't think even the leader knew exactly what was going to happen next at that point. But they grabbed Samsur and took him to the other side of the car and made him lay on the ground. I couldn't see him from where I was kneeling, but I heard a gunshot. I became hysterical. I was terrified. I was hopeless. Then they beat me up, told me to shut up or they would kill me too. They pulled me to my feet and pushed me toward the path in the woods. We reached to the top of another mountain, to a small house. An old woman and a man lived there. At first, I wasn't sure if the couple were friends with the Taliban or if my kidnapper just stopped at this house by chance. When they opened the door and let us inside, I knew they were in on it. I thought then they all had this plan all along to bring me here. They opened the door for us and we went inside of the house. They were all speaking Pashtun and I tried to figure out what they were saying, but I was distraught. Tears were rolling down on my cheeks. I couldn't believe my brother was dead. The leader came in, told me that we are going to call my father. I heard my father's voice, and I learned on that phone call that my father was alive, but that my brother was alive. They had only pretend to execute him, then set him free, and he would made it home. I was overjoyed, but my happiness didn't last. The leader said I had to tell my father I wanted to marry him and that I wouldn't be coming home. Up until that point, marriage had not occurred to me. I was still hoping they would just run the name. The threat of marriage added a new kind of terror. In Persian culture, bride kidnappings are controversial, but they are not uncommon. There is a whole etiquette around it. A kidnapping woman is ruined, and once she's ruined in this way, she has no options. If she goes to the police, and her kidnappers might face some civil punishment like having to pay her family, but she absolutely must marry the man. If she doesn't, she is treated as a disgrace to her entire community. Even if her immediate family support her extended family and community will not. If she refuses to be married, the family is permanently dishonored and disgraced. The family can restore that honor only by killing her. There is another etiquette for this too. Traditionally, a woman in such situation is buried alive by her family. This restores their honor and their grace. This is the future that now unfolded before me, and it began as I knew it must. After we called my father to inform him of the new plan, the leader took me into the basement of the old woman's house, and then there the three men came and raped me. The old woman brought me breakfast the next morning. I refused to eat anything. I didn't want their food, and I wasn't sure if they would put drugs in it. The man told me, you will be sad and you would cry for a couple of days, and then you would get used to this life. Their plans kept changing. They kept arguing with each other, and the people on the phone then making me call my father and ask for money. They kept moving me around, making me walk to one house to another house. Every now and then, we would hear approach of a helicopter, and they would all scramble to get out of sight, be quiet. The leader was serious about forcing me to marry him, and he was trying to make sure the whole thing seems legitimate. He wanted my family's approval. He needed them to talk to his political connection and commanders and make their consent known, their agreement. Through all this negotiation and people screaming at each other over the phone and hiding from passing helicopter, I started to form a plan. If the leader want this to be a legitimate marriage, then it would be reasonable for me to ask to see my family one last time before I was married. But as a hostage, I had no bargaining power. But as a prospective bride, I could at least ask that much. Once things calmed down a bit, there would be no reason for the leader to refuse that. I was ruined, and he knew it. What he didn't know is that my father was not a typical Pashtun father. My father wasn't going to kill me or force me to marry him. My father would die to support me. So if I could just get to see my family somehow. And my father came through for me. He went to the commander and did everything that leader told him. So the marriage was all set to go. But my father had also gone to police to convince them to look for me. My father signed the agreement with the elders and the Taliban representatives to release me to come home. He agreed that if I agreed to the marriage with the leader while I was home, he would support and even manage the wedding, but he made it clear to the elders, no woman can be forced into marriage if she was being threatened. Of course, everyone agreed to this. even though they knew that it happened all the time. Political and legal walls were now closing in, and my captors assumed that I was no longer of use to anyone but the leader of the Taliban. So he agreed. He agreed that I could go home one last time to say goodbye to my family. And this is how I ended up to escape after 3 days brutal torture and sexual assault.
Zizi, what age were you at that time?
I was 15 years old. And after this agreement, our small caravan made, like, we start going back home. And the leader of the Taliban and their bodyguards, they told me to look happy. And since then that I was thinking about going home, it was not hard for me not to smile. I start smiling and start looking happy. Our small caravan made a stop to pick a member of the provincial council named Zabit. Zabit was a politician who had real power within the Jalalabad government. He was also obviously connected with the Taliban. His presence made the whole thing look more legitimate. So he escorted me home thinking this would bring everything to a nice and tidy conclusion. I hated him, but with him there, I knew the others wouldn't just turn back. The happiest moment of my life was seeing the gate of my house and knowing I was coming home. The leaders, bodyguards, plus Zabit crowded into our house. The men filled one room and I was taken into the next room with my mother and sisters. We were all jumping for joy. My captors had tried to clean me up, but I was still a mess, covered in bruises, and my lips were split and bleeding bad. My sister brought some food for me, and I finally ate a little. I got some energy back, and I was so ready to do what had to be done next. I knew I was about to do something that would put my whole family in risk. And there was no telling how it would work out, but I knew it had to be done. And I knew I had the support of my family, and especially my father. I said I wanted to go see the men and tell them my decision. The room where the men were meeting was packed. The leader cousins, Zabit and his bodyguards, they all crowded around me. I could tell Zabit was anxious to leave and take me back to the leader and have done with all of this. I smiled at him. I said, thank you for bringing me home. Then I said, now you can all go back to the leader and tell him that I will never marry him and I will never stop going to school. These pigs who brought me here called themselves good Muslims and good men, but for days they have treated me like animal. And now they think I'm stupid enough to go back and I would rather die first. Zabit had tears in his eyes. And if you kill me, I said, I will stand before God and point my finger at every one of the men who put these bruises on me. I hope every one of them goes to hell and suffers what I have been through. Shame on every one of you who will go home tonight and kiss your daughters and wives after what you have done to me. Shame on you for your disgracing your families and your religion and your people. And after that, they all finished their tea and they left. It wasn't over, of course. It was just beginning, but that night was wonderful. The next day, I started going back to school, which was a big slap on the face of the enemy of education. My superhero father strongly supported me for education and for achieving my dreams. This was now a legal issue. The leader accused me of reneging on my promise to marry him, so it became a public matter. He was calling my father every day and threatening to kill our whole family. But the official government was on my side. The government, the governor met me and heard my story and even gave me a laptop computer. A lot was happening during these few months. I graduated from high school at the top of my class. Even though all these stress, even though none of my friends at school would talk to me because I had been dishonored. Even my best friend told me she couldn't talk to me anymore. By then, we were under constant threat from the leader. The situation became so high profile that the Jirga in Jalalabad met to discuss it. In Persian culture, the Jirga is like a community council who make decisions about Persian custom and law. The official view is that Afghan government was on my side, or at least claimed to be, but there was no pretense with the members of the Jirga. These were not men who had sympathy for a girl who was defying tradition and learning English language. They met and decided that I had to marry the leader of the Taliban, and that was the end of it. I refused. I met with them at a meeting of dozens of Jirga elders, and I told them what I told Zabit while he was drinking my family tea. I would die before I went back, and any Muslim who would condemn a girl to marry her rapist would one day have to face God to explain all this. This didn't move them, of course, and it pitted me and my family against the Jirga. Not long after my escape, the intelligence officer Aaron Thomas of the U.S. military wanted to meet me and my father. The U.S. intelligence officer interrogated my case and my security situation, and he offered me a translator and culture advisor position. He said, "You have so much potential in you, and you're a very strong woman. And this way we can get you out of Afghanistan." The agreement between the U.S. military, my father, and I was that I would be a very committed translator, and in return, the U.S. will give me special immigrant visa to help me get out of Afghanistan. Within a few months of my escape from the Taliban, I graduated from high school, and I went to work for the U.S. military. I became the first and only female translator for the U.S. military in my village, Jalalabad. At first, my father would take me to the base, but this became more and more dangerous. Even the guards at the base themselves, Pashtun, who were working for the U.S. military, called me a whore and thought my father was dropping me off at the base to pimp me. They couldn't imagine that I was a linguist. I was in many confrontations with them. They told me I shouldn't be working for the U.S. But then I told them they were doing the same thing. And the threats and attacks on my family only got worse and worse. Then I was working for the military. So after that, we moved to Kabul in 2013. And I had a press conference. I speak out against the Taliban. And when they saw me on the news, they came after me in Kabul. And me, my father, and my youngest brother, we stay hiding in the basement almost for 2 months. And the rest of my siblings with my mom, they stuck behind in Nangarhar province, and they were attacking on them too. But my family left everything behind in Nangarhar province. We all moved to Kabul province, and we start a new living in a new life here. Captain Thomas, who rescued me at the first place, he reached out to me and he said, "I saw you on the news, Zizi, everything is okay?" I said, "No, everything is not okay." I explained everything to him. And then he said, "I know you want to be a highly educated woman, and that's your dream. So here is financial help, and I want to help you, so go to university." Well, I went to university and I got admission there. So I got a very top score in that one of the highest standard university and in Kabul province. I got a scholarship for 4 years, and I got graduated after 4 years in 2017, and then I became a translator again, and then I started living on the base in Kabul on the military base. There on the military base, I was doing a very high-level job. Like, I was translating confidential and non-confidential documents and running meetings. And after that, in 2019, I moved to Sindi, which is the east part of Afghanistan, and that's another military base. When I moved to Sindi in November 2019, my responsibility had increased considerably, but the culture on the base had changed entirely. All my friends had been promoted or transferred or had gone home. In the military, you make a very intense friendship under the life and death circumstances, and then the person, one way or another way, will just be gone. Furthermore, this was after the previous administration negotiated with the Taliban and promised to end the war, but without any involvement of the Afghan government. I think this seriously affected the morale of the U.S. military, not to mention the morale of us locals who were helping the U.S. military. So before I go any further, let me make it clear that I have a very positive view of the military. Without the brave, honorable friends I made in the military, I wouldn't be the person that I am today. I'm sure I would have been died. But when I go back to Sindi, I began to be sexual harassed by my immediate supervisor. When I made it clear that I absolutely was not interested in him, he terminated my job and had me thrown off the base. He personally let me out of the base and dumped my belongings on the street. I was terrified. I was in the middle of Jalalabad with nobody covering. I was at the mercy of any man who came along. I managed to go to my sister's house in a cab, but I couldn't stay there. I was devastated at how I had been treated, and now I knew my life was in danger. I couldn't stay in Jalalabad. I had to get back to Kabul. The only way was another cab ride. But I had no mail escort again. I would be at the mercy of whatever man I encounter. This time, I wasn't so lucky. I got into the taxi. I told the driver I was going all the way to Kabul, about a three-hour drive. He nodded, and everything seemed fine. After about 2 hours, he made a phone call. I could hear him telling someone that he had a woman in his car all alone and asked where they wanted to meet him. He told them where he would pick them up. We turned off the road to Kabul and were driving into a remote area where there were only a few houses. My fingers were shaking as I texted my family that I was being kidnapped and the cab driver was meeting up with the people to rape me. I saw a parked car ahead and two men standing beside it. The driver honked his horn. I grabbed my backpack and tried to calm myself. When the car slowed, I jumped out and ran as fast as I could across the field. The men ran after me, screaming at me, grabbing my clothes when they caught up, but I tore away. I ran through the field and saw a man tending to a flock of sheep. I screamed for him to help me, that the men were trying to rape me. The shepherd screamed at them and told them to leave me alone, and they gave up on chasing me. I spread in my burqa and told him I was from the country, trying to visit my family in Kabul. I pretend to be religious and uneducated. If he knew the truth, he never would have protected me. but I stayed with his family for 2 days. They treated me very nicely, and he even drove me back to Kabul to meet my family. This was a very dark time. My career with the military was over, and I knew the Taliban would be returning to power soon. I felt very depressed and hopeless, but my friends, they came through for me. My old coworkers heard what happened to me at the base, and they all sent their support, most importantly, and my counterintelligence friends or contact, they contact Kyle. Kyle worked for a U.S. Congressman, Emmanuel Cleaver. He was working to get me a special immigrant visa to get me out of Afghanistan as soon as possible. The next few months were a long, it was like very, very long months for me, like a year. The bureaucracy of the State Department, I'm like very grateful that they didn't make it all the paperwork and all the trips to the U.S. Embassy and any easier, or all the time that my application were rejected or put on hold for some small reason or no reason, any less terrifying. But on the 10th of August, the State Department emailed me to go to the U.S. Embassy to pick up my visa after I was told to do the COVID vaccination to be fit for the flight, which was the most difficult and dangerous to leave my house. I couldn't leave my house. It was very terrifying for me. And every time, in every single email I was sending to the Department of State, I was mentioning to them that it's so hard for me to leave my house because it's very dangerous. I am taking my life on my hand to leave my house. And my country was about to collapse. It was like a couple days ahead of collapsing of Afghanistan. And the Department of State asking me to do the vaccination for fit to flight, which doesn't make sense in that dangerous situation. But I have no choice. I wore the burqa head to toe, and me and my sister, we went to the medical facility. I did the vaccination, and then I got another email to go to the U.S. Embassy in Kabul to pick up my passport with the visa. So I went there too. And then on the 15th of August, I was supposed to leave my home a couple hours ahead of my flight. But I received an email from my counterintelligence friends and told me to leave your house early in the morning. And that was the day the Taliban were inside of Kabul in the city, and they were building checkpoints. Early in the morning, I sent a text to Kyle through WhatsApp that I cannot leave my house because I can see the Taliban, they're building the checkpoints inside of the city. It's hard for me to go to the airport. And I am feeling nervous, and I have fear, and I'm very scared to the death. So he told me, you have no choice. You have to make it to the airport. So I covered my whole body head to toe, and my whole family came with me to the airport, so this way I couldn't draw any suspicions to the Taliban. While we were going through some checkpoints, one of the checkpoints stopped our taxi and searched our car. Asked the taxi driver, where do you go? But as he was like changing the way, and it took us almost 2 hours to get to the airport. I was sitting in the terminal waiting for my flight. My flight got canceled, and I could see the Taliban were coming through the Pakistan Airlines, going out of the city, or going out of the airport and taking control of the entire Afghanistan. My country collapsed right in front of my eyes. I was terrified. My body shut down completely. I couldn't feel anything. My body was feeling numb. My flight delayed for a couple hours, and Kyle was texting me if we took off. I said, no, the security operation is going on. The gunfire or the gunshoot is going on the other side of the airport. that the Taliban were celebrating their victory, and we couldn't take off. But finally, our flight at 6 p.m. took off. And that was a big sigh of relief for me, that after 10 years fighting for freedom and for peace, for education, I finally made it. It was unbelievable for me. It was a very long flight, 24 hours, but I couldn't stop all the way in 24 hours my crying. And my main concern was my family, because they left behind. My family, who sacrificed their whole happiness, their whole life for me, they risked their life for me to support the U.S. military, and they left behind. I was crying for them. It was mixed emotions. I was happy and I was sad. I was happy that finally I'm the winner, and I was sad that my family left behind. So I made it to the United States August 15, 2021, and after that, I settled in Missouri. I was there, and I'm doing motivational speeches for the young generation of this country, and I have written a book. I completed my manuscript, my book proposal, and now I'm looking for a publishing company. And I would like to be a very good advocate for women's rights. And I want to be the voice of those women that they cannot speak up for themselves. My story is not the only story of an Afghan woman. There are a million stories of Afghan women like me, untold. But I want to share their story. I want to speak up for them. I want to be a very good woman's advocate.
Zizi, I'm interested in knowing what happened to your family when you left. Are you still in contact with them on a regular basis?
I'm still in touch with my family. Situation is very bad in Afghanistan, especially for professional women who achieved their education during the youth occupation in Afghanistan. They had the privilege to go to school. But since the Taliban took the control of Afghanistan, they closed the school's doors in front of women. They cannot go to school. And my sisters, they're all nurses and doctors. They cannot work in the hospitals. And they put so much restrictions on women's rights. And the other thing is that the Taliban were searching houses door to door. They searched our house to look for my brother because his name is on the top list of the Taliban. Because of me, that I support the U.S. military, and multiple times during my service in the military, they even threat my family and attack my brother to return me to them and stop me for supporting the U.S. military in Afghanistan. My family never ever give up. And they always supported me to support the U.S. military. But luckily, they couldn't find my brother. But still, the security and safety situation is very bad in Afghanistan.
Saeed, do you have any questions you want to ask Zizi? Are you there, Saeed?
I'm here, Ron, yes. So, Zizi, I was going to ask you... you talk about the Taliban and everything about the issue of women in Afghanistan. I want to know, so you said during the Soviet period, was it better for women or?
And during the Soviet Union in Afghanistan, women had a lot of rights. Women could go to school. Women could go to colleges. Women could achieve education. Women could work. But after that, when the Taliban took the control of Afghanistan, on that end, that was the Mujahideen. Then they put
right.
a lot of restrictions on women, so they couldn't do anything. But during the Soviet-Afghan war, like Soviet Union in Afghanistan, women had a lot of freedom.
Yeah, but... But I had a question.
Go ahead, Penny.
Go ahead, sorry.
Go ahead, Penny.
I was
going to
make it very quick.
Go.
Yeah, I was going to make it quick about the Mujahideen. ZZ, wasn't the Mujahideen supported by the United States? So the U.S. government, you know, might have had a role to do with women in Afghanistan, wouldn't you think?
So during the Soviet Union in Afghanistan, so the Mujahideen were getting a lot of their financial and their armed support from Pakistan. So also the United States were helping the Mujahideen on that time to fight the Russians in Afghanistan.
Yes, did the Mujahideen? Did they allow the women in Afghanistan to go to school, to be educated, to work, et cetera?
Russians.
They did.
They provided opportunity for women to go to school, to go to colleges, to get education.
Okay. So currently, because the Taliban is still in control of Afghanistan, there really isn't much of a hope for women in Afghanistan.
So right now, being a woman in Afghanistan, being a woman in Afghanistan is the worst place to be a woman. Because Taliban, they don't even let women to go outside of their house without a male escort. Afghanistan went back to 20 years ago. What we have, we lost everything right now. Taliban even doesn't have the education and understanding of how to explain or describe their own government structure to the people, to the world. And they put a lot of restrictions on women. They ban women from going to school, from being educated, from working in the hospitals, from working as a professional. They put so much restrictions on women's rights.
Mm-hmm. Zizi, we got only about 2 minutes left. Anything you want to say in the last 2 minutes?
My message to the young generation and to everyone who hears me is never give up and always fight for the right thing and go to school, get advantage of this great opportunity, and at least people here in the United States, they don't have fear of being get killed going to school. I wish I had this opportunity earlier in my earliest age. So get and achieve the education here. Fight for the right things, be determined, and be positive, be hopeful.
Okay. Is there any way right now that you have for people to contact you?
I couldn't hear you well.
Is there a way that someone hearing this program could contact you if they want to help you?
Sure, of course. If anyone who wants to contact me, they can follow me on Facebook. Zamzam Safi is my Facebook. And also, I'm on LinkedIn, Zamzam Safi. They can find me on LinkedIn as well. And if anyone wants to contact me, I have email address. My email address is this, zamzama_safi@yahoo.com.
Okay, we're going to put that on the program information on this program.
Okay.
We're going to put all that info there. So people listening to this program in the archives, weeks, months, even years from now, will be able to contact you. We've got, looks like probably 30 seconds. Any last words? We've got about 20 seconds. ZZ, anything you want to say to close out?
I do appreciate you for inviting me to your show tonight, and it was a great opportunity, and I was feeling blessed and honored to share my story with you and with the audience.
Okay, the program ended. Okay, Vivi, I'm going to you should have the link. I sent
okay.
you a link. So check
the
that out. Stay in touch with you by email. And I'm going to update this program with your information. Just give me, email me the link to your Facebook and your LinkedIn accounts.
Sounds perfect. I will definitely do that, yes.
And I'll put those links in the information on this program so people who are listening to it will have it. And they can contact
okay.
you. And you want me to put
perfect.
The email too. So, yeah, that'll be good. Okay, Zizi.
Yeah.
Like I said, try that, the Sky Horse.
I will, yes. Yes. Even today I was talking about the Sky Horse with my friend who is, like, helping me through editing my book and stuff like that. So, I talked with him. He said, yes, it's a very big publishing company, but I will send them my query letter and also my book proposal. We'll see what's going to happen. I hope
yeah.
they respond to me.
Yeah, and if you don't get picked up by them and you try some others, as last resort, you can do what I do. I just self-publish through Amazon.
Yeah.
But give that a try with the publishers for the next several months and see where you can go on that.
Yeah.
Okay, Zizi, good interviewing you. And
thank you
I'll
so
you
much, Ron, for inviting me for your tonight show. It was wonderful. Thank you so much.
Okay. Okay, Zizi. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, Saeed, you still there?
Yeah, I'm here, Ron. I'm here.
Okay. Do you want to do a program? You know, on the current situation with the Biden, Trump, et cetera.
Yeah, no, we have to do one. That's very
You want to do one on Wednesday? Is that the best night for you?
Yeah, let's do Wednesday. That'll be perfect.
Okay. I'm going to try and make a note of that, and we'll figure 10 o'clock your time Wednesday, and we'll just cover the basic stuff. And have you kept up on Robert Kennedy?
No. What's going on with that?
Okay. The Republicans invited him to testify before a committee hearing on censorship. And
right.
the Democrats on the committee called him a racist, called him a conspiracy theorist, and a danger to the country. And you know that idiot gal from Florida, who is a Clinton crony. God, I can't think of her name now. She used to be the head of the DNC.
Right.
I can't think of her name. But Kennedy wanted to say something, and she told the chairman to shut him up, that he couldn't talk anymore.
Right.
and another gal, a black gal, beating crack. He wanted to say something after she got done chewing him out and calling him a racist. He wanted to say something, and she told the chairman to shut him up. And the chairman says, well, why are you trying to censor him? And she said, I'm not trying to censor him. I just want him to shut up. He's out of order. He's
right.
Not supposed to be talking. So all the Democrats did was claim he's a super racist. He hates Jews. He hates blacks. In his entire life, he's been pro-Jewish and pro-black.
Right.
And then he had one of his moron, brain-dead sisters go on TV and say that
right.
He's a racist.
Unbelievable.
So they're trying to... Clinton, all these people are working for Clinton.
Oh, yeah.
She's behind the whole thing, and she's got them out there and got the liberal media. The entire liberal media is calling him a racist and a bigot and a conspiracy theorist, and that everything he says is a threat to America, and he's putting the lives of Jews and blacks in jeopardy by what he's saying.
Right.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. So, okay, let's figure on Wednesday night then.
Sure, I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, see you. Thanks. Bye.